Hello and welcome to QSO. It's all about ham radio. And today our guest is Jim Davis, W2JKD. Or you may know him as Big Jim Edwards from a radio station somewhere like CKLW, KHJ Los Angeles, WOR in New York, or WLS. Well, he's with us today, so rather than talk about it, let's get started with QSO. And anyhow, I want to say that we have with us a special guest tonight. And and I'll tell you, let me give you just a little bit of background. If you've listened to radio when you were a kid, you may have been enjoying the radio show from this gentleman here. And his real name is James Davis, but you probably heard him on the radio as Big Jim Edwards. And he is joining us on WTWW as Big Jim Edwards. But he'd worked at CKLW in Detroit, worked at KHJ in Los Angeles, and I don't know where else. Jim, why don't you fill us in? Were you at KB in Buffalo?
Well, my mother worked there, Ted. But first of all, hi, nice to be on your show, and thanks for having me. And, you know, the story of those of us who have 27 radio stations under our belt is that we couldn't hold a job. You know, the old ad in Billboard magazine used to say, you know, tight board, no drifter. But yeah, my mother started at WKBW in 1934. It was the call letters stood for Well-Known Bible Works, and the station was owned by Clinton Churchill. He was a legendary broadcaster. Ultimately, the station was sold then to Lowell Thomas and what was known as Capital Cities Broadcasting. And of course, it was one of the early rock and roll radio stations. It covered up and down the eastern seaboard with that fabulous big 50,000-watt transmitter from a tower site south of Buffalo in a little community called Hamburg, New York. So that's where I was born, by the way, born and raised, and then went on to I'll let you pick it up. I'm sorry, Ted. I'm just sitting here yapping away, which is what you give me a mic and I'll yap away.
That's what you're supposed to do. As a matter of fact, they pay you to do that. You know, what I was going to ask you about that was Lowell Thomas. Now, I remember as a little kid watching these travelogues. I think we're like travelogue movies with Lowell Thomas, and he would narrate these things. Are you familiar with any of that at all?
Sure. Lowell Thomas's background was he was a World War II reporter out in the field, and was just a legend. I mean, he had these nightly newscasts from across the big pond, and he was a fellow who was eloquent with his words. I guess he was most famous for his newscasts during the war, and then later, as you say, when the evolution of television came along, which would have been, I guess, around 1948-49, somewhere in that neighborhood, hopped onto the what at the time was the first network in America, the CBS television network, and did a travelogue show.
I just remember the voice and saying, this is Lowell Thomas, you know, and announcing whatever it was that he was doing. I was just a little kid, but I remember him, and it seemed like I just associating him with travelogues, you know, or not necessarily, I don't know, documentaries maybe, travel. Anyways, not the normal.
There's a classic piece of tape, Ted, of him when, you know, one of the things that in the radio business that goes back, I guess, eternally is that whenever there was a microphone and a person performing in front of it, there was usually somebody to the side who was trying to make him laugh. And, you know, when you used to do a newscast, the common thing was to set the newscaster's wire copy on fire. Yeah, or pouring water into a bottle behind the into the wastebasket behind the performer. So, you know, it was whatever you could do to make the person laugh. And there's a legendary piece of tape of Lowell Thomas doing a serious network newscast where he starts to giggle, you know, while he's giving this very serious story. And the next thing you know, he can't stop laughing. And he just winds up crying as he shuts the microphone off. So it's a classic piece of tape. If you, I would guess if you Google it, you'd probably find it.
Now, my son David's sitting here, and when you said setting news copy on fire, he raised his eyebrows, and I can tell that's the first time he's ever heard of that. So why don't you tell him how many times?
What a good trick.
Yeah. That's one of the most common things that ever happened at a broadcast station. And if you had news copy in your hand, and here comes somebody with a cigarette lighter, you knew instinctively what was going to happen. And the surprise was if they snuck up from behind you. And
Ted, I'll have to tell you a funny story. I worked for a fellow by the name of Lowell W. Bud Paxson. He was in Jamestown, New York, when I was a little kid. I was just out of the high school and started in the broadcasting business. And I went to work for Bud for $75 a week and all the records you could steal in Jamestown, New York, on a station called WKSN, which stood for Kissin' Radio. And the FM, by the way, was WHUG, which was Hugs. So there was hugging and kissing. But anyway, Bud Paxson had sold this program in the afternoon drive called The Powers Pages of History. It was sponsored by a funeral home, and it was five. Here we were, a rock and roll radio station, and at 5 o'clock every afternoon, the station would flip format and read the obituaries for 5 minutes. And, you know, it was just too, I don't know, it was too easy to break the jock up on the air. So, you know, at the start, the program started off, you know, and now WKSN proudly presents the Powers Pages of History. And today in the Jamestown area, we report the sad passing of the following people. Mrs. Eleanor K. Rubottom was a member of the Early Morning Sunrise Club. So you can imagine, you know, here we were playing beautiful music behind this sad announcement. So every disc jockey used to run in behind this the announcer and just do every trick in the book that we could to get this guy to laugh on the air. And of course, sooner or later, it would just wind up as classical music playing on the air because the announcer was laughing so hard that he couldn't possibly get through the rest of the obituaries. So that's the Powers Pages of History. Bud Paxson, who, by the way, went on to become the owner of the Home Shopping Network, the guy that conceived that. Bud strolled into the studio and he flung open the door and he said, "Now the next one of you that makes my announcer laugh is going to be fired. Do you all understand?" And we all said, "Yes, sir, Mr. Paxson, we get it."
Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to QSO. Our guest is Jim Davis, W2JKD. And we'll be right back right after these messages.
And you know what you can do? You can buy that brand new ICOM 7300 from R&L Electronics. That's right, R&L Electronics. Or you can buy that brand new ICOM 7610 from R&L Electronics, or a new D-Star radio. I've been talking about R&L Electronics for a good while, and you've heard me go on and on about Roger and the crew at R&L. When you call there, you get answers. They answer the phone. The people answering the phone are knowledgeable folks. They carry everything. They've got transceivers. They've got antennas. They've got microphones. They've got coax, linear amplifiers. They've got antenna tuners. I mean, they've got everything ham radio. They're outfitted for the radio amateur. What a place to go. You'll love dealing with them because they're great people. You'll get great service. Everything will be shipped out promptly. There's nothing worse dealing with somebody that doesn't take your order seriously and you don't know whether or not it's going to get there on time. Believe me, I've been there. I've been there ordering ham gear. That does not happen with R&L Electronics. Roger and his folks care about you and they care about the fraternity of ham radio. They want to keep you going. They want to keep it going. For the best price, the best possible price, and the best service and quality from individuals that know the amateur radio hobby and really care, remember the name R&L Electronics. Go up to the web, go to Google, and put in R&L Electronics. Contact them and go to their website, and you can't go wrong. What about giving the fraternity of ham radio to a new prospective ham? And you can do this by giving a subscription to Ham Test Online. There is nothing like it. Ham Test Online, unbelievable training program that you do at home on your computer, and you, the gift giver, can help Elmer someone without the toil of Elmering. If you feel a little uneasy, like, well, I don't know if I could actually Elmer somebody, Well, rest assured, when you give a subscription to Ham Test Online, the job is done. They've done all the work. All you have to do is the encouragement part. Calling on the phone, sitting down with a prospective ham as he kind of runs through the questions. Now, this program is programmed so that when you answer a question, if you don't know something, it remembers what you don't know. And it cycles the questions around again, along with diagrams and explanations, so you really get what you're studying. There's nothing like it, I'm telling you. It's fun. It's not boring. It doesn't take up hours and hours of time. You aren't reading useless information that's not even on the test. Why not give a subscription to Ham Test Online? Do you know somebody that you'd like to see get into the fraternity of ham radio? Man, this is it. This is it. Give the fraternity of ham radio something that will give to that person for the rest of their life. It's Ham Test Online. Remember that name, Ham Test Online. Go to their website and get signed up. Let me tell you a little bit about the ICOM IC7610. This is a high-performance RMDR receiver, transceiver. This thing will pick out the faintest of signals, even in the presence of stronger adjacent signals. And the 7610 is a direct sampling software-defined radio, and it's going to change the world's definition of SDR transceiver. That's the ICOM 7610. Yes, and how about the ICOM 7300? Man, now this is a contester's dream. It's a high-performance HF transceiver with a compact design. It doesn't miss a weak signal under any circumstances. And it's got the waterfall function and the real-time spectrum scope. Man, it's exactly what you need if you're a contester. But you know what? Either one of these radios are just incredible rigs to have and for a long, long time to use. ICOM has the reputation of being incredible in the performance and also the service they provide to you as a user of their electronics and their ham radio gear. Go to ICOMAmerica.com/amateur. That's ICOMAmerica.com/amateur. A lot of folks are just plain disgusted what they see going on in our country today as we've departed from the Bible and the precious truths that our country was founded on. And if you're that way and you'd like to hear some really good solid Bible teaching, excuse me, without all the BS and all the other things that you see on television evangelists, then tune in 9475 during the day and 5830 at night for Scriptures for America. Go to their website and sign up for a free publication called The Dragon Slayer, and it is cool. You want to find out what the devil's doing, how to combat him and keep him out of your life? Sign up for The Dragon Slayer. That's an incredible publication. It comes out every month. It's free from Scriptures for America. Once again, tune in 9475 during the day, 5830 at night. But don't do that. Don't do that unless you've got some fortitude, because it's the real deal. This is Bible teaching where the rubber hits the road, friend. Scriptures for America on 9475 and 5830 at night, or go to their website and listen online.
One of the best kept secrets in ham radio is an online publication called The Spectrum Monitor. Have you ever heard of it? Well, if not, you need to go to their website, thespectrummonitor.com. That's thespectrummonitor.com. Each month, all kinds of pertinent articles pertaining to ham radio, shortwave, citizens band, scanning, Wi-Fi, you name it, it's in there. Color pictures, incredible writers writing these articles. You just have to check it out. You need to subscribe.
go to thespectrummonitor.com. Once again, the website is thespectrummonitor.com. Give it a look over and subscribe. thespectrummonitor.com. Here at the QSO Radio Show, we really need to hear from you. Go to our website, simply qsoradioshow.com. That's qsoradioshow.com. And you'll see all the past podcasts up there and other information. But go to the part where it says email Ted and send us an email. And be sure and put on that email, I want to win, because always giving something away. Go to the website. It's simply qsoradioshow.com and send us an email. And while you're at it, be sure and friend us on Facebook, QSO Radio Show, and follow us on Twitter, QSO Radio Show. And thank you for listening.
Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to QSO, and now back to our guest, Jim Davis, W2JKD.
So that was the end of the Powers Pages of History story.
Well, you know, another funny thing that I saw happen was, you know, the wire would come off of a, you know, UPI machine or AP machine, and you would, you know, they had the common term rip and read, you know. And right. Anyhow, but it had its own distinctive looking type, okay? So you could tell if somebody had, you know, put it in a typewriter or something. However, at one station, and I, you know, what happened was, is this, now this was in, I'm trying to think where it was. It was in Flint, Michigan. What they were doing is the news guy was famous for rewriting the copy. You know, he would take the copy and he would sit down and he would rewrite it, because AP and UPI copy was notoriously bad. I mean, it was, you know, it was just bad. So he would rewrite it. And at some point in time, the newscaster on the air, what was his name? I can't think. Anyhow, they handed him the copy, and he had rewritten the copy to where it was nothing but complete nonsense and gibberish. And it had something to do with, in the middle of this story about monkeys going up a flagpole, and, you know, I mean, it was just, and this guy's trying to keep a straight face and read this thing and try to figure out what in the world is this saying, you know, because it was a rip and read, you know. But sure, he had the monkeys going up the flagpole, and everybody was just breaking up laughing. It was one of the funniest things. But I mean, when you rewrite, go ahead.
We pulled the same kind of trick on a young disc jockey by the name of Pat Berry, who went on to have a terrific career as a weather forecaster in Cincinnati. But in Indianapolis at radio station WNDE, we typed up we knew that Pat was a notoriously poor reader. So we typed up a commercial and handed it to him, said, oh, this is the, you know, we knew that he wouldn't pre-read it. So it just dropped under his face, and he opened up the mic and read this account of Jake Snow's used car lot at the foot of the mountain in Brownsburg. Now, if you've ever been to Indiana, you know that there's not a mountain any place for 1,000 miles around. So anyway, he read this, you know, we have fine cars from $1 up to $11 at Jake Snow's used car lot at the foot of the mountain in Brownsburg. We regret to announce that Jake Snow passed away the following day, and funeral services will be held this weekend at the Powers Pages of History. So, yeah, you know, it just goes round in a big circle.
That's
good times.
Priceless, good times. Yeah. Yeah, I do remember a commercial one time that was, you know, introduced into the studio, and is that crazy thing over there? That there's an Alexa in here, and every once in a while it just starts talking. I don't know, nothing sets it off; it just goes. Anyhow, they had taken this commercial and had typed it up like 3.5 or 4 pages long and stapled it, and it says 60-second spot, but you could tell if you read it all the way to the end, you were supposed to flip to page 2. So they gave it to the guy, and he had 4 pages of copy to read, and you could tell he was frustrated, running out of breath and wondering, when is this going to be over with? And while everybody else is just, you know, laughing their butts off, thinking it was so funny.
Now, I always laughed because in sales, you know, it's funny because as an announcer, you know, you have these boundaries of how many seconds you can go. Many times you have to fit into an opening in the network or a newscast or whatever. And 30 seconds has to be 30 seconds. 60 seconds has to be 60 seconds. But somehow many salespeople just don't understand that. And so they'll hand you a piece of copy that's 2 pages long and say, this is a 30. It can go no longer than 30 seconds. And we know that this is 30 because it's marked at the bottom as a 30. You know, whereas the salesperson had written the number 30 at the bottom. You know, that, you know, from newspapers, they use the -30- to indicate the end of a story, not the timing of the story.
Well, what I was wanting to get into here, you know, if you don't mind, you know, what I'm curious about is the very, very beginning stages of radio for you. Like, what, I know your mom was on WKBW, okay, but let's go with whatever. And, you know, there's a lot of times that parents are in a particular profession and the kids don't want anything to do with it. You know, it's like, that's just not me, you know. But what was it that drew you in? And then the next question is how did you go? Did you go into ham radio first, or did ham radio come after broadcast radio? Kind of fill us in on a little bit of this.
Well, I like to listen to you better than talk about me, but let's I'll go for it here. The story, my mother was in radio. I used to go to the studio with her. If she was had a performance of some sort, I would go into the studio. I fell in love with the studios. I loved the smell of it. You know, I loved those old ceiling tiles with the holes in it. I loved the big microphone booms and the RCA 44BXs or the 77DXs. And, you know, I just loved the big 16-inch transcription turntables. And I think the thing that did it for me, I was in the newsroom one night while my mother was singing in the other studio. This would have been 1959, and the old Model 19 teletype was clanking away, and I read that Buddy Holly's plane had crashed. And I went over to the newscaster, and I said, you know, this is a bulletin. And he said, oh, yes, it is. And he went right in on the air, and I thought, well, that is so cool that you were serving the public with this information. So, yeah, I knew right from the get-go that I had this interest in the broadcasting end of things. But ham radio came first, Ted, and I'll tell you how it came about. I was in school. I was in junior high. I was 12 years old. I was walking home from school, and I saw that the YMCA had a course in how to get your ham radio license. And I thought that would be really cool because I had already learned Morse code. Okay, how did that happen? Well, when you were in Boy Scouts in the 1950s, you could get a merit badge if you learned the Morse code. Now, I learned it completely the wrong way. I learned Morse code off of flashcards. And any of you who are hams know that absolutely there is no worse way, to learn the Morse code than through flashcards. But anyway, I took the YMCA course. There was a ham. He was a W-2. His name was George Downs, and he taught me the theory. And in those days, the guy that taught the class could also give you the novice test. And so in January of 1958, I was licensed as WV-2. Remember, there were Vs for novices. WV-2-HWF. And I absolutely fell in love with it. I built an ICO 720, which was the 6146 radio transmitter. I had an old Heathkit AR3 receiver and worked field day when I was 12. Gee, I had a good time with it. And then I saved up some money and I got my National 109 receiver. And then I was really in business. So I was a novice for 6 months and I was 12 and a half years old. And I went down and I took my general test. Now, this is the days when you actually had to copy 13 words of Morse. And there was an old mechanical machine that had had paper tape on it. And as the contacts would move through the paper tape, it would send Morse code. And I took it in the Buffalo, New York post office where the walls were made of marble. And it just reverbed through the through the post office. I'm amazed that I was ever able to copy straight one full minute out of the 5 minutes that they sent, which was the requirement at 13 words a minute. And then the technical test, too, the written portion of it was not multiple guess. It was actually you had to draw circuits. You had to draw tubes and grids and plates and filaments and calculate out resonant circuits and things like that. So it was definitely more complicated. Well, I was on 75 meters one day, and there was a fellow who became kind of a mentor for broadcasting for me, Bill Deesing. He was N2ANT. He still is. And he was on 75 meters. He wanted to learn the Morse code. I thought I'd teach it to him. And he said, oh, by the way, I'm a disc jockey at WNIA in Cheektowaga, New York. And all of a sudden, it just clicked. He said, you seem like you have an interest in the broadcasting business. I said, hey, I've wanted to be in the radio since I was a kid. And, you know, Ted, I think that I believe there's a spiritual part of this, too. I think that God gives you gifts. And if you can discover what those gifts are, then I think life is a whole lot easier. And for me, I believe one of my greatest gifts was my voice. And so anyway, I started to hang out at WNIA. I really wanted to be on the air, but I was only 14 years old at the time. And the owner of the station, his general manager, whose name was Mary Lounsbury, Mary used to throw me out of the radio station all the time. And she'd say, kid, get on your bicycle, go home, do not come back, and just stay out of here. We don't have visitors. So I'd say, okay, Mrs. Lounsbury. And I would, you know, I'd go down the street. I'd wait till she got into her Plymouth Valiant and she'd drive off, and then I'd pedal my bicycle back again. And she was just so tired of throwing me out that she finally said, kid, obviously you want to work here. And I said, yes, I do. She said, well, I'm tired of throwing you out. She said, how old are you? And thinking very quickly, I said, well, Mary, how old do you think I have to be? And she said, well, you have to be 16 in order to work here. I said, well, I'm 16. Well, I really wasn't. I was 14. I lied about my age. Well, she thought she was going to get me because she said, well, if you're going to become a disc jockey, you have to learn to pronounce classical music names. This is crazy because it was a rock and roll radio station. But I said, okay, I'll take your test. And anyway, she had a little Webcore recorder with the magic eye on it. And she pressed the record button. She handed me this sheet of paper that had all of these names on it. But I spoofed her because I had taken piano lessons and I knew how to say Rimsky-Korsakov and I knew how to say Mozart and, you know, all of those complicated names, Beethoven, Brahms. And so she said, well, kid, you got me. I'm going to start you on the air on weekends, 9 hours a weekend. I'm going to pay you 90 cents an hour. That was the minimum wage at the time in the state of New York. And so in the summer of 1960, I went on the air as Mac McGuire, the live wire. That's kind of it in a nutshell, Ted. It was ham radio that got me into the broadcasting business.
Okay, so you had a an Ico 720, which was the infamous CW transmitter for... I guess what it operated 10 through 80, did it not? With crystals, you hit a, you know, you there was no VFO control on that thing.
That's right. It was a really nice, well-designed radio. You know, historically, Ico was a pretty darn good company. They were kind of a competitor to Heathkit and some of the other home-built kits at the time. But they made a beautiful matching modulator for this 6146 rig. That was called the Ico 730. And basically what they did was they took one of their high fidelity amplifiers and they changed the output transformer so it would become high impedance, and therefore they could put it in series with the plate lead on the 6146, and they could modulate that thing to, I think, around, I don't know, maybe I'm going to say about 40 watts of AM. And it was a really nice kit. Every once in a while you find one on eBay, and they're kind of a collector's item. They're a little bit rare, but you know, if you're looking for a classic CW transmitter, yeah, that's a good one. And so then after that, I got a VFO. I built a Heathkit VFO because Ico did not make a VFO, and plugged it into the little Ico, and then I was able to slide up and down the dial. My first rig, by the way, I'll tell you a funny story, Ted. I was on... 40 meters. I was rock bound. And of course, when I started off as a novice, it was CW only. And like many stores around, many cities around the country, we had a ham radio store in downtown Buffalo. Yeah, you would never think of ham radio stores in most of the communities today, but almost every city had one. So I went down there and I wanted to buy a crystal for my Ico. And here was a box full of crystals, and all the crystals, I think, were like $3.95. And so then there was this one crystal that was right smack dab in the middle of the 40 meter CW band, and it was only 50 cents. And I said to the fellow, I said, does this crystal work? And he said, oh, yeah, I'll fire it up for you. And he put it in a radio, and sure enough, it transmitted right where it was supposed to transmit. And so I said, well, I'll take the 50-cent crystal. So I took the 50-cent crystal, took it home, plugged it in the Ico. It tuned up real nice, and I could spot myself on the receiver. And then I listened to what was on 7.157 megahertz, and it was Radio Moscow.
So that's why it was 50 cents.
That's the story behind the 50-cent crystal.
Well, you were talking about, you thought that, some people had gifts. I would have to say that in addition to the gift, in order to get you to use the gift, I think that there's a God-given fascination that there is no explanation for. And the reason why I say that is I grew up in the Detroit area, and there was a place called Dearborn Furniture in Dearborn, and I was just little. I mean, just little. And they took me in there, and it used to be a theater. So they were in there looking at these Lazy Boy recliners, and I happened to notice that on the stage was a floor-standing microphone. And I like to drove everybody crazy in order to get over there to that microphone. And I remember my mom telling the story. I must have been 4 or 5 years old at the most, you know. And I couldn't rest until they picked me up and let me talk into that thing. And it went over the loudspeaker system in there. And, of course, to me, at that time, I really and truly thought I must be on the radio. You know, I must be, you know, and I've thought about that. What causes, you know, that kind of draw to something? When there's a million other things in that store that I could have been drawn to, but that for some reason I couldn't get the microphone off of my brain. And
I agree with you, Ted. I think we're predisposed to that. I didn't become a very good pianist, I mentioned that I took piano lessons, but I'll tell you a story that's kind of reflects on that. It's my mother was a wonderful musician, and she loved Liberace, and she loved Liberace's music. And so she wondered when she heard that he was sick, she said, I wonder if we could go see him before he passes. And so I brought my mom to New York City. We went to Radio City Music Hall, and we watched the fabulous pianist wear out 12 pianos. He was just amazing. And it was at that moment that I said to myself, you know, the sign of the true master is those that perform the seemingly complex with ease. He just glissed over those keys. And it was very apparent that he had the gift. Now, I would struggle with chopsticks, but, you know, he just had it. So I think you're right. I think we're predisposed to do certain things really well. And I believe that there is a magnetism to that, and it's a spirit.
I think you're right, and I think but I think a lot of folks miss that. They really do. They miss it. It's like it's there, but they don't see it. And right. My dad died when I was about 11 years old, and I had a piano, and I had took piano lessons as well. But mm-hmm, I was more mm-hmm. fascinated with the mechanics of the piano. And there was a fellow by the name of Frank Lonis in Dearborn, Michigan that had Dearborn Piano and Organ Company. And right. he knew that my dad died, so he asked me to come in and solder connections for him. So I went in and did that in his big theater, the Rogers Theater Organs. And I remember got in there with multimeters and checking diodes and stuff in there. But the fun part was I had taken a bar, an aluminum bar, and put it to where you could screw it into the sides of the piano on the inside. It would raise up and down. And then took a, it wasn't felt, it was kind of like a leather thing. leatherette type thing, and it looped over the bar, and you could cut individual slots out for each hammer. And then I put paper clips, those little squeeze paper clips, at the end of each one of those, with the exception of the bass notes, which I dropped a piece of, it's very similar to newspaper, but it was a little bit more substantial, and put an automotive choke on it, the choke control. And you could pull that choke, drop it down in front of the hammers, and it took on a whole different sound. And we Frank Lonas had a decal made that said, "This piano is equipped with Rinky Tink." So we sat
isn't that great?
We sat in the back room. I sat in the back room building these silly things. And I think he was charging like $19, and he put a couple of ads in some music magazines and stuff. And boy, they were selling like crazy. And a lot of that was going into nightclubs and bars where they wanted to have a little different, a different thing going on, where they had maybe a, and then the other thing that he had, and I don't know if you've ever seen this, it was an instrument called a Chamberlain, and it used a whole series of tapes, and you'd push the button and the tape would roll, you let the key off, and then it would rewind, and it had every instrument on earth you could think of recorded into it, and it also had all sorts of barnyard sounds and animal sounds. So I used to love to play Home on the Range, you know, and make all these weird noises and stuff. But I think that right there opened me up to the idea that it's the mechanics behind it. You know, in other words, learning how does this thing work, you know, and organs fascinated me to no end. And because everybody had a different system of generating tones. But go ahead. Only reason I'm saying that, because I really think that sometimes when we follow our interests is when we really do the best that we can do toward anything in life.
You know, Jeff Lawrence, who I think you're going to have on your QSO show tomorrow night, he and I are both from Western New York, and that's where they made the Wurlitzer organs. And it's kind of an interesting study. They used to have a theater in the round right next to the Wurlitzer company. So, we got a chance to kind of study and follow organs at a young age. I learned to play on a church organ when I was a kid. Like I say, I wasn't very good at it, but the study of the organ is really tremendous. And you're right, when you think about the synthesized sounds that we have today, I would say this. My son studied over in Orlando at an Academy of the Recording Arts, and by that time they had a machine which actually had sound samples of some of the great artists of the day. You know, it was Stevie Wonder playing the harmonica, and you could actually press the keyboard and hear Stevie playing. But let's go back to the organ for a second. You know, Wurlitzer, which was made in my hometown, made an organ called the Mighty Wurlitzer. It gained its fame really from the motion pictures. They used to have Mighty Wurlitzers during the days of the silent movies. And this huge, monstrous pipe organ would come up out of the orchestra pit. It would turn towards the audience. And then when it was time for the movie, it would turn 90 degrees and face the screen. And the organist would make this music up that went along with the silent movies. But there was a little trick to the Mighty Wurlitzer, and that was the things called the pistons. And, Ted, you probably know this, but the foot pedals down where you play the bass notes, the big, heavy 32-foot bass pipes, the little silver knobs up on top of that were called pistons. And when you hit those, they were the sound effects. They were bells, chimes, gongs, whistles, police sirens. And you'd hit those along with the, you know, with the movie. And basically, that's how you gave the drama to the movie. It was the sound effects rack that was built into the Wurlitzer organ.
Well, that was something that Bob Heil has demonstrated over and over again. He's got an organ called an Allen, I think.
And it is an Allen, yeah.
And it's, I guess what they've done with this thing is they've taken the big, you know, like the Mighty Wurlitzer theater organ, and they have recorded it all into this thing so that it digitally reproduces a big theater pipe organ. And it's strange because when he demonstrates it, he plays piano or like human voices and things. It's just like dead on. In other words, you listen very close. It's hard to tell, you know. But I think now tell me something. Working in the radio business and working around music, do you not believe that your knowledge of keyboard instruments and things like that added to your ability to understand the music you were playing?
Yes, I think so. But I also think that you have to also become educated in what the public wants to hear, which is a completely different thing. I tried to develop what I would call two sets of ears. I tried to develop the esoteric ear that could appreciate E. Power Biggs playing the big pipe organ, but I also tried to develop a commercial ear that could hear the hook, so that when I could listen to a song, I would say, okay, there's the earworm, and that's what it takes. It takes an earworm to make a hit record. And so, yeah, I tried to definitely understand. I just finished a really good book about understanding how music came to be. As you may know, we have a scale called the chromatic scale, which is the 13 notes based on octaves of eight octaves, and then the five black keys. And that's not common all around the world. In fact, it's not standardized. There are places in the world, of course, there's 320 countries, I guess, in the world, 330, something like that. And many of them have a different standard for music. So that means that a piece of music that you play wouldn't be able to be played in the same key. We based all of ours on harmonics and multiples. But you would find, particularly in Asian music, that the structure's not the same.
No, and to our ears, it's, at times it sounds pretty strange, sounds weird. You know,
yes, it sure does.
It doesn't follow the same pattern. And then by the same token, to those folks, our stuff sounds strange, you know. But there is something weird, I think, and that is, well, I guess what I was saying, though, when you were playing top 40 rock and roll, okay, and you ran into a song, say, for example, like, oh, goodness, The Rapper by the Jaggers is a good one, you know. The way the song is laid out and the instruments that are used to give the effect of the music and then, of course, the vocalists and everything, I think, this is my opinion, I think that having a background with a keyboard of any kind, piano, organ, you know, and learning music from that standpoint, when that song came on, You kind of got it, maybe quicker than other people. You could hear, you know, you could hear the melody, you could hear the harmony, you could counter melodies, you could hear other things going on that maybe other people just didn't notice. You know, they liked it, they liked what they were hearing, but I think you tend to understand a little bit more about what you're listening to. Now go ahead and shoot that down for me, because that's just a theory I have.
You know, I think you're right, Ted. It's kind of a study of the human brain as to our recognition of tones. You know, when you think about it, my XYL Patty, who's K4PAG, Patty is, she would say by her own account that she is totally tone deaf. She can't sing along with a song. She listens to CW, Morse code, and it's just a blur to her. For whatever reasons, whatever it is inside her cerebellum there, those dots just don't connect. So she is, she's out of luck when it comes to that. On the other hand, I have a friend of mine whose name is Nikolai Brunov. He was a legendary disc jockey in Dallas under a different name. But Nick, his father, who was a Russian immigrant, was the director of the Dallas Symphony Orchestra. And both Nick and his dad have what's known as perfect pitch. Now, that means that you can go, and he'll say, well, that's a C, but it's a little bit flat. So in his head, he has registered. No, it's true. He has this incredible ability to just listen to tones. And I said, oh, what a wonderful gift. And he said, no, it's not a gift at all. I said, how could that not be a gift? He said, it's a curse. And I said, why could it be a curse? He said, because everything in life is off key. And I thought, isn't that weird? You know, I see where he's coming from.
Well, sure, you know, we were doing an interview with Ronnie Milsap. Yeah. And we were talking about music, and I said, who is your favorite artist, you know, of all time? And of course, he said, Ray Charles, you know. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, what about the song, What I Say? He said, oh, it doesn't get any bigger, better than that, you know. So he starts in, and he starts going, like that, you know. He's humming this song, and you know, he yells at me, come on, Ted, you know, come on, Holly, and whoever else was there. He's like, and then he started, you know, he started singing it. You know, well, I got back to the studio and I had the recording, and I thought, you know, what would be really slick is to play What I Say while he's going into this, you know. Yeah. So I go ahead and I get the recording up, and I got him up, and I'm trying to sandwich them together, and I discovered something very peculiar, and that was, not only was he in perfect pitch with that song, he was in perfect timing with the song as well. Mm-hmm. It sounded like he was actually on the original recording.
Yeah,
it was uncanny. It really was. And there is a fellow who has perfect pitch, and I don't care what it is. He can tell you what key it's in, and you're right. He can say it's a little sharp, it's a little flat, mm-hmm. you know, and so I don't know. That's a real strange gift, but it's yeah. just as real as rain, because I couldn't believe it. I really couldn't. When I was putting that thing of him humming up against Ray Charles, I thought, my God, it's like he's right in the studio, you know. But yeah. that was something else. That was a lesson that I learned. You know?
What a gifted man he is. What an amazing talent.
And, of course, you know, he's one of us.
Yep.
So
yep. One of us.
Yeah, he's one of us. Yep. Now, and for those that don't know, Ronnie Millsap, which is a prominent country music performer, I can't imagine that someone wouldn't know who he is. But if you don't know, that's what he is, and he's also been blind from birth. Now, he told his whole story, which was really amazing to me, that while he was in school, him and a friend of his, and he said he could see just a little bit. He could just barely see the sidewalk when he was walking. And he and his friend were on these pianos, and they were playing, I guess they were probably playing Ray Charles, I don't know, but they were playing some pop music. And the music instructor came in, and he got mad because they weren't playing practicing their classical music. And the teacher hauled off and hit his friend and knocked the guy right off the piano stool. And so he said, Ronnie spoke up and said, well, what did you go do that for? And then this fellow hauled off and hit Ronnie right in the head and knocked him off the stool. And he said he woke up the next morning and that was the last of his vision. That had destroyed his vision. And it's really tragic to hear him tell the story when you think about it. But then, boy, I don't know. You know, you look at somebody like that and the accomplishments that they have, and you know, anybody that's handicapped and has to get up in the morning, you know, and deal with no sight or no legs or something like that. It's mm-hmm. and yet those folks rise far above our achievements, you know, and how they do it is just by the grace of God, I guess, and their perseverance, you know. And
my wife Patty is disabled, Ted, and she's in a wheelchair and has been since she was 18 years old, recovering paraplegic, and she constantly amazes me. It's like the words can't do are not in her vocabulary. It's like she just figures out a way around it. I came home one day from work, and she was up on top of our camper. She had the air conditioner unit taken apart, and she was lubing it. And I said, how did you get up there? She said, oh, it was simple. She said, you know, I got up in the back of your pickup truck, and she says, then I got a stool, and I put the stool up on top of the cab of your pickup truck, and then I kind of slid up the back of the stool using my arms. Then I was on top of the camper, and I thought, man, you know, what an amazing ability to come up with an angle that you can be able to make your way through life with that kind of an attitude, that can-do attitude that so many handicapped, what we used to call handicapped, now, you know, the word disabled is no longer in her vocabulary. She is very able.
Now, well, that's, you know, and I guess, you know, that's an important way to view things, an important way to look at things, you know, and we've been taught the wrong way. We've been taught, clearly the wrong way. And when you see, and I've got friends. I got one friend in particular. I guess he's probably got four doctorates that is in a wheelchair for life from polio. And of course, Ronnie is an inspiration. When you thought, it's really strange when you go over there. He never turns any lights on in the middle of the night. You know, he just, you know, but he knows. And when you watch him work on a computer, he can work circles around me with his the jaws software and all that. I mean, he just, it's like you hear, and the thing responds so quickly by voice, and before a word is completed, he knows from the first two letters of the word, when it, you know, it starts to say something, he knows exactly what that is, and he's on to the next thing, you know. So you sit there, to you, it sounds like gibberish, you know, but but he navigates, he just navigates perfectly. Well, okay, now let me ask this question. You got into, you said that was the beginnings of getting into radio, okay? Mm-hmm. But there's a big gap between where you were, where you wound up, you know, and where you went, and then the beginnings, okay? So most people, I think, remember you from Top 40 Radio. If they remember the name Jim Edwards or Big Jim Edwards, they remember you from CKLW, what, KHJ, and did you use that name anywhere else that you were, that you, OR New York. You were in New York City at WOR. Why don't you talk?
Yeah, the only place I ever used my real name was WLS in Chicago, which stood for World's Largest Store. But, you know, I worked for a company called Drake Chenault, and they owned your name. So wherever you would go, they'd give you a fake name. So that if you got an offer from the competitor across the street, that you couldn't use that name. So yeah, that's I never got to be me.
Well, tell us a little bit about WLS. Now, was that in the beginning of your career, toward the end of your career, or which way? I mean, when I say the end of your career, I mean Top 40 Radio.
I would say, Ted, my break really came in 1967. With the station in Windsor, Ontario, CKLW, which was a 50,000-watt station. It was a Canadian station. It hadn't done very well. And when they put the new format in the spring of 1967, it just went off the charts. And within a period of a year, it had the 22 share of the audience, which has been unduplicated in the Detroit area any time since. And it was the number one station, not only in Detroit, but in Fort Wayne and Cleveland, Erie, Pennsylvania. It was one of the most powerful stations in the Midwest. And during that period of time, it just dominated. I remember driving down Woodward Avenue in Detroit in the summer of 67. The convertible tops were down, and you did not need a radio because every radio that was playing up and down Woodward Avenue was on CKLW. I got a really big break there. It was... I was on a little station in Toledo, Ohio that had 12 towers. It was called Wido in Toledo. And anyway, one day the owner's wife came in and said, we'd like to play Frank Sinatra music and some Nat King Cole. So, you know, I learned right there to never go to work for a radio station that was owned by a meatpacking company. So anyway, those of us that loved Top 40 Radio, we wanted to keep the turntable spinning. So, my friend Ed Bush, who went on to have a good talk radio career, he suggested that I might send a tape up to Paul Drew, who was building a team up in Detroit. So I took him up on the idea, and I could do nothing except fake a tape at the station because we were playing, you know, easy listening music. So I sent the tape up to Paul Drew. I kept my fingers crossed, and I remember very vividly it was a Saturday morning. It was 1967, October. I was learning to fly airplanes, and I was practicing touch and goes at the little airport at Ellington Aircraft Salvage Company in Toledo. You know, never work for a company, never go to fly at an airplane company that has a terminal. But anyway, the radio cracked with the voice of the owner of the airport. He said, "I just got a call from your wife. She said it's important. Land immediately." So I hurried from the sky to the little field base operator. I borrowed the phone to call my wife, and she said, "Jim, you'll never believe what just happened." I said, "What, Sylvia?" And she said, "Well, this guy called who said he was Paul Drew, and I knew it wasn't him, so I said, 'Yeah, and I'm the Easter Bunny,' and hung up." So his secretary called back and said, "Mr. Drew would really like to talk to you." So... anyway, Paul said, "I heard your tape. You sound fake." I said, "Well, I faked it in the production room." He said, "Make another one." And he called me on Sunday afternoon, and he asked me if I could be into his office early the next morning. Needless to say, I couldn't sleep that night. I was afraid of getting stuck at customs. I was up by 5 a.m. By 7:30, I was sitting in the lobby of the old CKLW on Riverside Drive in Windsor. And about 8:30, the receptionist, who went on to be the legendary Rosalie from Bob Seger fame, said that Mr. Drew was very busy. He should be with you shortly. And then what happened, and it was kind of a fast-moving locomotive. Paul appeared in the lobby and said, come with me. We have to go to Motown. And so we zipped over. It was the first car I'd been in that had a mobile telephone, the IMTS, the improved mobile telephone service. And I remember thinking how expensive those toys were. So anyway, the conversation was very fast-paced, and Paul explained how the station had a bad reputation because it was Canadian. He said, I don't care what problem your station has. If it's FM, which was not popular in those days, if it's a daytime or low-powered Canadian, if it sounds great, people will listen to it, and we're going to make a great-sounding radio station. So we pulled into the old lot of the old 12th Street Motown studios, and I stayed in the car. Paul went to the back door and knocked, and for a brief moment, a brown envelope appeared into Paul's hands. We were back on the road headed to Windsor, and Paul explained that he had the new Supremes exclusive, which he would have for a minimum of 12 hours before the competition had the record. It was really exciting. The whirlwind that surrounded Paul was evident. So on the way back in the car, Paul said, I'm sharing these things because I assume that you're coming to work for us. Well, Ted, that's all I needed to hear. My heart skipped a beep, and I knew that I was being hired by the Big Eight.
Now, that's a cool story. So how did you go... How did you go from sitting in Paul Drew's car from behind to behind the microphone?
Well, Paul was a very, you know, those of us in broadcasting today know that pretty much it's kind of it doesn't have the same intensity that it once did. And Paul met me at the station for two weekends in a row while I was giving my notice. And had a large fur coat carrying an old battery-operated Zenith Transoceanic. Remember those with they had the A batteries and the C batteries. And I went into the studio, and he sat with me for the entire 6 hours teaching me how I was supposed to do the format. There was definite tension in the air as I punched the mic button for my first words on CKLW. I can tell you that I noticed that my hands were just shaking like a leaf. But anyway, I spent 3.5 years there. It was a terrific experience. And, you know, it's for me, it was everybody has, I guess, a breakthrough. And that was the breakthrough for me. And you know, by the time I got hired there, the station was doing the Christmas Wish promotion. And I realized that my Christmas wish had come true. I was a Big Eight jock.
Well, you know, you had an interesting story because the amount of, I guess I want to say, the perfection that was demanded then in radio at that time, especially at that station, you told a story where you forgot the call letters or something. Tell the folks that because that's priceless.
Yeah, that's an interesting aspect of it. Yeah, I was very, very nervous under Paul. Paul was not a person who would make you feel very comfortable. He was a fellow who was very, very insistent upon the mechanics being exactly like he wanted them to be, and as well he should have. But yeah, I was on the air and I flubbed up. I flubbed really badly. You know, I came out of the stop set at 7 minutes after midnight and said, I said, well, whatever I said, I went into the break and he said, he took off his headphones and said kind of angrily, he said, you forgot the call letters. You may have lost us valuable listeners. So I want you to instruct your engineer. We had engineers at the time. He said, I want to instruct your engineer to play the same record again, play the same spot again, and see if you can remember to say the call letters this time and try to never do that again. So, you know, I was on the edge for the rest of the night. There was really no more conversation. And, you know, Paul simply said, tell your engineer to play more music fast to fast and record number 1, 2, 3, 4. That was it. I was absolutely sure that that would be my last night on the Big Eight. But when 6 a.m. arrived, I was tired. Paul and I packed up and left to announce booth number 3. And as I went for the door, he said to me, he said, "That was the best first effort I have ever heard." So I knew I had a reprieve until the next night. And I did 3 more overnight trials before I hit the airwaves full time on November the 6th of 1967. I started the same day, by the way, as the legendary Byron McGregor, who was just a fabulous newscaster.
That's, you know, that's amazing. To try to hear you tell and this timeline, you know, because the problem with that station is that it went through a metamorphosis, if you want to call it that, because there were, like you said to me at one time, there were different versions of the format under different people. A lot of disc jockeys coming and going, you know, which is real typical for radio. It doesn't really reflect that there was anything wrong with the station. That's just the way the business was. And but it's interesting to hear the timeline, because I know the way, you know, it's funny, because I think folks like myself, you remember things, but not necessarily in the order in which they occurred. And so it's easy to, I guess I want to say, mix things up, or mix and match, you know. But I, you know, and I'm that way. I don't know. Maybe it's because I'm just getting old, but I'm that way about life, period. I can't remember. Sometimes I can't remember what came first. You know, when did I do this or would I do that? I remember attending a church out on the west side of Detroit. And I also remember working at a religious station in Detroit. And it had to be simultaneously, but I can't connect the dots. The dots are just not there. As try as I may, I cannot remember. Do you have things,
Ted,
like...
I think there's a wonderful thing about human life, and again, maybe this is a spiritual thing, but it kind of launders the bad times. We kind of remember the good times. You know, I'll give you an example. You look back at your high school, and you'll probably say to me, you know, I had a great time in high school. Well, chances are it wasn't that great, but, you know, this laundering process that kind of lets us remember the old times as good times, I guess we would call that nostalgia. And it doesn't necessarily have to be an accurate portrayal of the past. It's just the way we remember it.
That's probably the case. It really is. You know, let me ask this question now. You got your ham radio career is running parallel to your broadcasting career. And I know it is, because when I first started talking to you, you started talking about the RCA F50s at CKLW, the RCA F50 at CK. And the,
sure.
You know, it's... you know, it's wonderful, warm sound and the bottom end and all the things that this thing had that was not duplicated by a brand new transmitter, you know. And so you were following this. You talking about unequalized lines and a number of things like that that told me, you know, you were technically attuned to where you were and what was going on, which is not the case for many people in the broadcast business. So do you think go ahead.
I think just remember, I got into this because I was a ham, and you know, I really thought that I was going to become an engineer. That's what my training was at. You know, I studied electronics, but honestly, when I realized that the turnover amongst disc jockeys was a lot higher than it was amongst engineers, I said, "Oh, this is great. I'll just grab a DJ job until I can get a good engineering job." And 57 years later, and it's you know, what can I say? I never was an engineer, but yes, I think you know, I always was fascinated by the human. I guess human senses. I know a lot about the eye and the ears, and you know, the ear was an interesting study, and I read a lot of interesting material about that. You know, the Bell Laboratories was the I guess Western Electric, the offspring of Western Electric, and they were the guys that had a difficult time in doing long distance calls across the United States. Our technical friends will understand this. Tube amplifiers were noisy. And so when you strung 100 of them together to try and get to California, it just didn't work. I remember my father calling my uncle Walter out in Chicago, and gee, there was a lot of noise and static, and dad would talk loud into the receiver and say, "Hey, Walt, can you hear me out there?" And Walt would go, "And what'd you say, Walt?" So anyway, Bell Laboratories realized that they could not push the technology. Technology just hadn't come along to the point where they could string amplifier after amplifier together. But they had two very, very bright engineers. They were named Fletcher and Munson. and they worked for Bell, and Fletcher and Munson had an idea, and that was, let's see if we can learn how the human ear hears, and if we can find out what frequencies the ear is most sensitive to, we can design a microphone that might be able to have, I know Bob Heil is perking up out there. Bob is saying, okay, he's on my wavelength now. Fletcher and Munson noticed that if you stand next to a foghorn, or you heard the 64-foot pipe on that Allen organ, or the 32-foot pipe, be it whatever it is, he said, there's this beating against your chest that's powerful, this feeling of intensity. And yet you can you can stand next to a foghorn and it goes beep, beep, and it's like pounding your chest, but it doesn't hurt your ears. But if you stand next to a policeman's whistle, that little 3,000 hertz tone, or 1,000 hertz tone, or 2,000 hertz is very painful. So Fletcher and Munson started to plot what they could learn about the human ear, and from that, they developed what you and I would know as the carbon button microphone. It was known in Western electric circles as the T1 element. It was the screw-in element into the old phones. It shook a box full of carbon granules, and it was very, very tinny. It was thin sounding. And guess what? That thinness made the difference. They didn't waste any frequencies. There was nothing, if you study audio, it's like you can't get things through the keyhole that don't fit. So they developed this very thin, tinny carbon button microphone. And all of a sudden, my dad could call his uncle Walter, my uncle Walter, and they could hear each other perfectly just because of the development of a mic. So, yes, I've always felt that if you wanted to have a radio station that was loud and clean and jumped out of the dial, it burned the crabgrass off of the base of the towers, you better understand audio.
It's funny because when I was a kid, I discovered I could take a D-cell battery and hook it in series with that carbon microphone and a speaker, and I could talk into that thing, and the speaker would reproduce my voice,
Cool.
That was
cool, right?
And then you could take, there was a number of things you could do with those little carbon microphones. And then if they ever got to where they sounded bad, all you had to do was take them out of the telephone and smack them several times on the table and unpack the granules, put them back in, and it was like a brand new mouthpiece, So, but now let me tell you what's crazy today. Let's talk about today for a minute. Let's talk about a company by the name of Nielsen, okay, who has produced an encoding process that they believe or claim that they're putting it on the air behind the music, masking these tones. There's 10 of them, and they're right smack dab in the middle of the Fletcher-Munson curve, okay?
That's right.
And you can hear them, and once you hear them, you never, it's like don't see an elephant. Once you hear these things, you've got it for life. My phone rings.
Earworm.
Yeah, this friend of mine calls me up out of Detroit, and he says, what's going on? I said, what do you mean? He says, radio stations, all of them in Detroit, they sound horrible. What is this? And yeah. I said, I don't know what you're talking about. Well, I didn't at the time. It hadn't hit me, And then it dawned on me. It dawned on me. The Nielsen tones. And supposedly now, the little pagers you wear, or they call them people meters, are sensitive to the tones and pick them up. Except I maintain I don't believe they work. I think this is like, it's like the Wizard of Oz, okay? They work after a fashion, but, we've done a lot of testing on these things. The thing I can't figure out, though, and see, we lose touch with things. Here you have the Bell system or Bell Laboratories experimenting. They come up and they hit the most sensitive part of the human ear is the Fletcher-Munson curve. And where do these clowns put these tones? Right in the middle of the Fletcher-Munson curve. Don't they know anything about this? I know you work in radio, and you don't have to comment on this because I'm always politically incorrect, okay? This has been a curse to the broadcasting business, and people will spend $15,000 on an audio processor like the Omnia 11, or you know, the Air Aura made by Wheatstone, put these things on the air, and then we jam these tones up into these processors. And the tones are non-sinusoidal. They are like something between a triangle, square, sawtooth. I don't know. They beat up against each other, and they make harmonics that go all the way up into 9, 10 kilohertz. I've even seen it mess with the pilot, the stereo pilot at 19 KC on the air. So I don't know. I mean, we go forward in technology, and then I think we take a step back. But the fact that you understand this Fletcher-Munson curve, and that's what enabled telephones to work over long distances, I think that's phenomenal, because most people don't know anything about that. And you'll hear, you know, Bob Heil will rant about it, you know, and he's right.
Yeah.
You know, he's totally right, you know. And his microphones are based, especially the ones that work DX, you know, the ones that are designed to work DX. You know, they kind of have it. What was it? Chip Margelli said it makes you sound like your shorts are too tight, you know, but it punches through, because it emphasizes that part of the hearing where the ear is most sensitive. Anyways, that's enough of my rant. We need to move on.
It's a good rant. We should probably explain to listeners that, you know, Nielsen is the company that determines the popularity of radio stations across the country, and they've done it for TV stations for years as well. But of course, when a radio station in a market is highly rated, as you can imagine, the revenue from that station goes up dramatically, because there are more listeners to it, or statistically, there are more listeners. But you know, a researcher would tell you that in order to have valid research, you need to achieve what they call replication, which means that two study groups could be conducted simultaneously and they would have the same results. So, you know, the complaints over Nielsen for years were that the only way we judged whether stations were popular or not is, you know, Nielsen sent out diaries. These were little booklets, sound just like they were, and they were labeled for a week's worth of listenings. And people would write in there, okay, I listened to Ted Randall from 9 until 9:05 on WTWW. And then that one person would be extrapolated to represent thousands of listeners. As you can imagine, it really was an unpure science. And so Nielsen was forced to go into something that was technologically a leap forward. And so they developed, like Ted says, these little pocket pagers that a small portion of any community will wear. People are compensated for that, by the way. They get, you know, a buck or two or $5 or $50 or whatever it is to wear these things for a period of a year. And it's supposed to capture what station exactly the pocket pager wearer is listening to. But as you can imagine, it's kind of what I would call drive-by listening. In other words, you know, you're in a supermarket and they're playing, you know, WZZZ, and your pocket pager picks it up, and all of a sudden you're credited with 30 minutes of listening to a station you've never heard of. So it's an inexact science at best.
And it's I still think that the radio business needs something more accurate and something that really actually does measure what the audience is doing. And I think their sampling is too small, but we're off on a tangent. We're not talking about...
Here's what I know. If you put great product on the air, people will listen. That's as simple as... you know, radio has really declined in value amongst the listeners because it's no good. You know, the average radio station in the average market is what I would call computer closet radio. It's a hard drive radio, you know, interspersed with a liner or two that says, you know, the best of the 80s, 90s and more. Yeah. And we expect people to listen to that. And guess what? They can get the same thing off of Pandora. So, you know, they've lost their many stations, not where I am, but many stations have lost their local impetus.
I believe that's true. And I think, you know, more than anything, and you know this better than anyone from working with the Drake format as close as you have over a long number of years, but you've probably been exposed to the Drake format longer than most of the disc jockeys that ever worked at CKLW or any other Drake station. And that is, I believe the Drake format was set up in such a way where you became the listener's companion. You, it was like you were the tour guide for the hour, you know, and you
said it.
You go right straight through this whole hour, and it's one-on-one. Because we were having a discussion about, I think it was Reverb, and and you were saying that Bill Drake believed that it should be a very intimate one-on-one type experience, you know.
Which, yeah, you're talking in somebody's ear, just like we are. We're having a conversation, and hopefully we've included the listener.
So, that, you know, that's a... To me, that's a, let me ask you a question. What was going through your mind after you'd been at the Big Eight for, oh, I don't know, a year or two? You know, did you begin to feel very, very comfortable? Or are you still sitting on the edge of your seat every day? And what exactly do you, how did it feel to be working on a radio station where you, there were more people listening to you than any other group or any other broadcast facility, you know, within miles and miles and miles?
Yeah, that was the seventh most listened to radio station in North America, by the way. So, yes, I think you were always on your edge. I used to say to my mother, I said, Mom, you know, I've been in this radio all my life. And, you know, sometimes I open up the mic and I look down at my hands and they're shaking. And she said, that's a sign of a professional. She said, you need that to get your adrenaline rush so that you'll be on your game, so that you'll be at the peak of your game. So, yeah, I was always, in fact, to this day, if I am going to do a performance someplace, I want to make sure, you know, I can stand up in front of an audience and do my best, but I want to practice it. I want to rehearse it. People love the night show hosts. I used to love Carson. I thought he was spectacular. You know, when he would come out on stage, people thought that he did that monologue off the cuff. You know, you and I know he spent 6-8 hours during the day with a team of writers practicing and rehearsing. You know, you just can't you can't wing it. I believe that if you're going to give a professional performance, then you need to practice. You know, I just took my biennial check review in flying because I want to make sure that I'm on my game. You know, flying is very unforgiving. You know, in radio, you only get fired. In flying, you get killed. So, you know, I think it's a matter of practice makes perfect. And, you know, so, yes, I was always on my my game. I, you know, of course, I was lucky enough to transfer. CKLW went down the drain very quickly when the Canadian government decided that they were going to, you know, take a whack at it and force the station to conform to Canadian rules. And they forced out the owners, RKO General, which was a spinoff of Howard Hughes's company, Radio Keith Orpheum. It was represented the Orpheum Theater chain, and Howard Hughes was the guy who put that all together. But, you know, it, the radio station was up on the chopping block before you know it. And then it got itself into some legal troubles. And over a long period of time, RKO General was found to be a felon, and felons can't hold licenses, and all of the RKO stations were stripped. But, yeah, anyway, I never really got over that sitting on the edge of my chair. I think the audience expects that. You know, if you're going to phone it in, they're not going to listen to you. They want somebody who's working at it for them.
No, I think companionship, too. I mean, you're driving along in your car, and that voice on the radio, you feel you know this person. You feel you get to know them, especially you listen every day, you know, and they're there every day, and it's the same friendly voice, and it's up, it's smiling, active, whatever you want to, you know, full of energy, I guess, is probably another thing. And you get to where you identify with that. That's missing today. That's not there.
Right.
You can go 4 or 5 songs, never hear a word. 3, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 commercials in a row, and then, you know, and after, you know, 4 or 5 records, a guy comes out and says, "Well, it's 20 minutes past the hour," blah blah, and then into a 9 commercial stop set. I mean, it's like, who in their
right? Well, I think broadcast stations are in search. Broadcast stations are in search of a path that's going to bring them success. I think most stations are still trying on their morning drive show to present entertainment, and I think a lot of them do. But that's changing a little bit, too, in that morning television has taken over in a lot of homes. Programs like Good Morning America and The Today Show are highly rated amongst the 25 to 54 female in particular that radio stations are trying to reach. So, you know, definitely things are changing. But I still... I submit, I may not be correct in this, but I submit that if you put great product on the air, if you fascinate people with what you're saying, you communicate with them, try to be, you know, earn their respect, and then follow through for them. Be the leader. You know, be, culturally, you want to teach them about what's going on. You know, we're proud as Americans, I think, to say that, you know, we are the leaders in the world in the cultural revolution. Let us talk to our listeners. You know, I learned how to comb my hair. I learned how to dress. I learned how to what music I should like. I learned how to dance from people like Casey Kasem. Casey was on WBNY, my hometown station, when I was a little kid. He was an upcoming disc jockey. And I listened to him to find out how to be, you know, in tune with the times, if you would.
And that I think that's the other thing, too. I think and I was going to ask a question. I lost my own train of thought. You were talking about the trends, or you know what's trending, but I think that a radio station has to portray the image of I guess I'm going to say, for the lack of better terms, of being the hip thing to listen to. You know, it has to be an acceptable thing. In other words, everybody. And when you're talking about going down Woodward Avenue, the same thing was true. Like if you went to a beach anywhere near, like Metro Beach in the Detroit area, as you walked down that beach, every transistor radio tuned to 800 kilohertz, all tuned to CKLW. So in order to, that in itself supplies a certain amount of peer pressure to the rest of the general public, you know, that everyone is listening to this radio station. I need to, if I'm hip, I need to listen to it too as well, you know. But I don't think you can get there without the product. You have to have something, like you were saying, that fascinates people, compels people, and holds their attention. And of course, that station was set up to do all of the above and then some. So, but anyhow, one of the things I did want to ask you about, we got off onto broadcast radio, but every time we talk about broadcast radio, we always get an abundance of email. People just love to hear about it, but I was going to ask you now, let's talk about your ham radio thing. Now, are you a DX guy? Are you a contest guy? Are you a rag chew guy? I know you've got a bunch of repeaters over there where you live, so that means that, you know, you're into VHF, UHF, maybe some data. What do you do there? How do you fit into the amateur radio fraternity?
Well, Ted, first of all, it's my 60th year as a ham. Yeah, I'm 72, so the math is very simple. 60 years as a ham, continuously licensed, by the way. And here's what I love about ham radio. It never gets old. You know, when I first started, I talked about building tube-type radios. And I'm sitting in front of my ICOM IC7300, where I'm listening to 5.085, by the way, out of my other ear. And in front of me is a nice Ameritron AL811. I've got a big antenna tuner, old Heathkit 3,000-watt antenna tuner. To the right of me, I've got the original Heathkit mobile sideband, single sideband radio, the first ones they ever made in 1962. Patty found them at the Orlando Hamvention a couple of years ago.
The monobanders?
Yes. No. These are all 80 through 10.
Oh, okay. All right.
And of course, no work bands, but oh, they're beautiful. If you go on my QRZ webpage, you'll see those radios. And also, I've added another thing to the collection, and that's a kilowatt Warrior amplifier.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, this would be about 1959, somewhere in that neighborhood.
Okay, now that's got four 811s in it, and it runs 866 Mercury vapor rectifiers, unless you've modified it, and you can get another maybe 200-300 watts out of it if you short out the choke and the power supply. But go ahead.
Well, that's interesting, Ted. Yeah, but anyway, I mean, that's my classic radio station. That's my classic, and
but which
here's
Heathkit,
what I love about what,
which,
what I love
which
about our hobby.
Heathkit transceivers. Which one? Well, you know, 101s. What are you? You said original sideband Heathkits. Which ones are they?
Well, I have to look. Hang on for a second here. It's the HA20. Okay. All right.
Okay, it's the HA20 and the HR20, which, by the way, you would know those as the Cheyenne and I forget whatever the
probably
other
the Mohawk.
One was.
Is there a Mohawk and a Cheyenne?
Yes. You know, I don't remember the Indian names, but mm-hmm. I can tell you that this one was the only one of the Heathkit line that didn't have an Indian name because it was rushed to market when sideband became popular, and they did a conversion of what was their mobile radios at the time. And to convert them to sideband. They did a beautiful job. I will tell you, to this day, I work on those radios at least once a month. I warm up the tubes. If I'm going to transmit on it, I warm them up the night before because it drifts so badly. but I get great reports. People tell me I have great audio on them. They can't believe that I'm talking on a 70-year-old radio, but it's the truth. They're just absolutely beautiful. So anyway, what I love about our hobby is it's so diverse. You know, when I first got interested in something else aside from silly sideband, as they say, remember when I started off, it was AM and everybody made fun of single sideband. It was never going to make it. Well, of course, it made it.
They called it slop bucket is what they call it.
Slop bucket. That's right. That's right. So anyway, about 1968, I was working in a two-way shop and I bought this Hammerland FM50A. Out of a bakery truck in Detroit and to 2 meter FM. And I had it on 146.52. I never made a contact. It sat in my car. Every time the ignition would come on, the radio would come on, but I never heard a person on it. Then I got transferred to New York City. I started my career on WOR FM. And one night driving into Manhattan, I hear somebody on 146.52. It was Mike, K2QMN. And Mike said to me, he says, you know, we have a thing called a repeater here in New York, and I'll tell you how to get these crystals, and all of a sudden your radio will come alive. And it did. So that started me on the 2 meter FM journey. I made the first Heathkit, the radio that had the little dip switches on the front, so you could, I don't remember the model of it, but I built that for 2 meter FM, and it was synthesized, so you can go up and down the dial. And then I got interested about the same time in amateur television. You know, the channel 57, 57, 56, 57, 58 of cable TV happens to be in the 440 band where we were doing analog television. So I've always had tower sites that I could make use of. So I built my first amateur television repeater in Indianapolis, and then built another one in Charleston, West Virginia, for analog repeaters. And we had some users that really, really enjoyed that mode. As I said, I'm a flyer. Our airplane to this day still has a camera mounted on the bottom of the fuselage and a 440 antenna so that we can broadcast from the airplane in beautiful analog television. I'm about to make the switch, but that's another story. But also, you know, sliding into the digital modes, the amazing new digital modes. I mean, particularly the low power whisper modes and things like that are just stunning to me. You know, I just got on WinLink. I'm not sure if you're familiar with WinLink, but it's an alternate forms of email that you can do over either VHF or HF, and very reliable, very dependable. Many times you'll be copying, for me, signals on 40 meters or 20 meters that I can't hear a thing coming out of the receiver, but the software hears it and gets it. You know, so those are a couple of I happen to live in a radioactive community. I live in Vero Beach, Florida, wonderful place along the east coast of Florida. By definition here, we're about an hour's drive south of Cape Canaveral. We're about an hour and a half north of West Palm Beach. We're 6 miles west of the Atlantic Ocean. And this tiny little community has 7 digital repeaters. Thanks really to a couple of folks who have made it possible. Craig, K4CPJ, brilliant guy. We have, right now we have 3 DMRs on the air. We have 4 D-Stars on the air. And, you know, we have over 100 users on the big D-Star in town. So, you know, we're radioactive and a very good local ham community that's really driven some youth into it. We have QRP sessions every Saturday. We have Digital University once a month for those people that are having a difficult time in learning the new digital modes. We have a Facebook page that's called Treasure Coast Digital Radio. And if you're having trouble with DMR or D-Star, the Treasure Coast Digital Ham Facebook page is an awfully good place to be. We have to approve you, but we approve you in nanoseconds, and you'll find code plugs and all the things to get up and going on the newer technology so that it doesn't baffle you. So, I don't know. That's it. I'm sorry, Ted. I'm rambling again. Radio people do that.
That's what you're here for, to ramble. Okay. You know. Yeah. No, it was interesting when you were talking about the EH-810 because I built two or three of those things. Matter of fact, I've got one sitting here on the floor that I need to go through that somebody tried to attempt to turn it into a CB amplifier. So I'm going to go in there and undo all of that whenever I have time. But, you know, that's the problem. You know, when do we find the time to do some of these things we want to do? I mean, that's been this. And, of course, now you're in retirement. So you're maybe in a little different sort of thing. You're not following a schedule and taking care of groups of radio stations and things like that. But to me, I envy the people that have time to do things like, well, let me get this big amp and set it on the table and pull it out of the case. And what in the world did they do in here? And go through it and make it work. But that was a phenomenal amplifier, especially. Well, what I did when I was a kid, I shorted the choke out and put 572Bs in there instead of 811s and pushed it to the limit. It turned the tubes cherry red. Wow. But it it was those were good. But I was asking about the Heathkit, because one of the very first transmitters I had was a Heathkit Marauder, and it was a single sideband thing, and sideband. Once again, I had a Marauder, also had a SX-101. It drifted. The worst thing, as far as drift was concerned, was I built the Ico 753 tri-band kit, and that thing you'd have to put a clock drive on the VFO, and it really drifted. I finally actually got it under control, but my God, it was a job. And then once you got it under control, of course, you already had moved on to something else, in the shack. But Heathkit, I miss Heathkit. I really do. I think that was, old Joe, NEB out of Nebraska, I'm sure you know I'm talking about. He's the Cat in the Hat guy at Dayton. He's really into kits. I mean, he'd tell you all kind of kits there is, and I've got friends of mine that's built stuff he's recommended, and it's really fascinating. And the days when you and I were into it, we could go down to the local TV repair shop and abscond with television chassis and a soldering iron, spend a couple of days, boy, you got a part stash, and you could build all kinds of things, but today it's...
My first linear was built really out of... a bunch of old high voltage supplies from TV sets.
My goodness. So what was it? What tube complement was in that?
I built a bunch of them, but I guess my most favorite was a 4-400.
Really? A single 4? Yeah, that's
single 4-400.
Cool. I had a pair of 813s, and I don't guess I've seen an 813 in ages. I don't know if they're still around. I haven't seen 813s, and I'll tell you, the other one, which they referred to as the brown bottle, was the 807. And I haven't seen any of those around anywhere. But those things were plentiful inside of the RCA 1M kilowatt transmitter that ran 4 833As and 807s and every other place, including the oscillator. And those are beautiful old transmitters. I don't know. Now, so do you do any AM work? Everybody talks about AM, and do you do any AM at all?
Well, Ted, I since we're talking worldwide here, I will tell you that in my back garage I have a Harris MW1. Now that was the first solid state kilowatt AM broadcast transmitter made by the Gates Harris folks. And I got it in my back garage, fully operational, by the way, and it slides very nicely to 160 meters. But like you talked about before, the only thing you need in life is more time.
Yeah, so there you go.
I've been offering to give that thing away to anybody for at least a year. I don't have any takers. I think it probably has something to do with the fact that it's 700 pounds and it operates off of 220 and it's only about 55% efficient. So, some of the negatives.
A McMartin transmitter here that ran four 400s, a kilowatt. And one of the local stations had suffered in a flood, and they lost. I mean, it was amazing. The floodwaters out of the Cumberland River covered the top of the transmitter building. It was completely underwater. And so we had this thing in the garage. So we and a couple of the engineers from BBN, we took and put it on a different frequency, put it on the back of a trailer and hauled it over there and put it on the air. And it worked fine, and it's still sitting there. And David and I, at some point in time, are going to go get it and try to bring it home and put it on, 160 or 80 at least, and have some fun with it. But
now my fascination with this, boy, you're talking my language now, Ted. I have to tell you a story that goes back to 1961. WBNY in Buffalo, New York was a 500 watt at 1400 on the dial. Now, I guess you couldn't get too much worse than that. And they had their tower on top of the Erie County Liquor Authority building in downtown Buffalo, where all the liquor had to get its tax stamp before it went to the local stores. So anyway, I told my dad, I said, I really want to buy that transmitter at the upcoming auction. He said, okay, son, let's go do it. So I was 16 years old and we hopped in the car. We went to the auction. I bought the transmitter for $50. It was an old RCA. It was so old, Ted, that it had lead sheathed cable. So the high voltage wires were wrapped in cotton, and then they had lead shielding over the top of it. So that's the kind of vintage that this transmitter was. So needless to say, it was huge. It was big. I was going to put it on 160 meters, and my dad rented a trailer. We went to the Erie County Liquor Authority building. He said, do you have any friends? I said, well, I got this guy. He's a ham, but he's a member of the Buffalo Road Vultures, which was the motorcycle gang in downtown Buffalo. So I called him up. I said, Bobby, I said, could you bring some of your buddies? And, I said, I'll pay you guys. You come up, help me get this transmitter into my dad's trailer, then help us get it off at my house. So we could put it in the garage. Bobby said, no problem, Jim, we'll be there. Saturday morning, we all showed up at 8 o'clock. We took the elevator up to the 14th floor. There was that big, beautiful RCA transmitter. The Road Vultures, they got that thing, struggled with it, got into the elevator. I thought we were going to break the elevator. We got it down into the trailer. I thought for sure we were going to have four flat tires when we got it on that trailer. We carefully and slowly took it back to my house in Snyder, New York, and the Road Vultures helped us get that thing into the garage. I thought, oh my goodness, that thing is so heavy. And with that, they opened up the two front doors on the front of that RCA transmitter. And inside, the Road Vultures had packed that thing from top to bottom with stolen liquor from the Erie County Liquor Authority building.
Oh my goodness.
So I guess the statutes of limitations have expired on that, so I can now tell that story.
Oh man, that's priceless. Oh my gosh. Yeah. Anyhow, did they share?
Well, I wasn't, nor am I, a drinker. I just choose not to, but it's just.
But you could have used that to clean the heads on your reel-to-reel tape machine.
I guess that's true. I guess that's right.
A little Q-tip and a little vodka, and away you go. Yeah. Yeah.
There you go.
That's a priceless story. That's
good, isn't it?
That one, that's something else. Yeah, that's really, really cool. Well, now, let's move on to something else here. Let's move on to something else. We are currently, because we'll be out of time here just shortly. We are currently in the middle of a project, Jim. Why don't you tell the folks a little bit about what kind of mischief we have gotten into?
Okay. Well, we have an interesting project that Ted created. Ted, you probably have shared this story.
I didn't create it. I'm just complying. Go ahead, though.
Okay. All right. Well, if you listen to 5085 with some regularity, You know that not only does it serve the amateur radio community, but it also serves those of us who love that 60s-based rock and roll. And Ted has been kind enough to take on the project of doing a radio show. I think I don't know how Ted ever sleeps because he's on the air. Every time I turn in 5085, there's Ted playing the hits. But Ted and I got to know each other. Ted, you and I think, have known each other for years. But somewhere along the way, you conceptualized this idea of maybe having some of the old timers. I hate to say old timers because I'd like to think that we're young timers as well. But yeah, the idea of having us kind of recreate some of that magic, that nostalgic magic of that great era. You know, when you think of the aura and the era of the 60s, when we saw the birth of the brand new format that we called rock and roll, late 50s, early 60s, and then all of a sudden there was the Nashville sound, there was the Philly sound, there was the Motown sound, and then, of course, the British invasion, and we got those great groups like the Dave Clark Five, the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, and so many others. And for most of us, you know, we would tell you that that music sounds as good today as the day it was released. I can tell you that when Fun, Fun, Fun by the Beach Boys comes on the radio, I take that knob no matter what I'm doing, and I crank it up, and I turn it up, and I love the beat. I love the intensity. I love the fact that it's positive music. You know, I think we live in a generation where it's tough. I don't know. Maybe it's age. I hope it's not age. But I look around and I go, what kind of influence are we making on our kids? You know, what message are we sending them with the music, with the, you know, the sexuality of the music, the intensity, the violence, you know? And the music of my time was a very simple, happy, fun-loving the genre of that was just delightful. And I think for most of us, it's still there for us. And maybe I'm sounding like my mother who liked Montavani. I don't know. But Ted has allowed us to collect some like magnets. We were attracted to Ted and said, geez, let's see if we can't bring it back to what it used to be and get on the air and have some fun. This station goes around the seven continents and with a really, really big signal. And 51% of the world does not have internet. And so, you know, these shortwave stations that come into the hearts and homes of people in Africa, in Europe, in Asia, and of course, the continental United States as well. Yeah, we can bring that message of culture. This is what we do. This is who we are. This is how to comb your hair. This is how to dress. This is how to dance. And so a bunch of us have gotten together, and one by one, we're attracting more of us to build what we hope is a great tribute to the American culture. Thank you, Ted. That's all I have to say. Thank you for allowing me that opportunity.
I don't know what to say about that, because this is a collection of incredible talent on the radio, you know, and I feel very privileged to have these folks even want to, you know, enter into a radio station that, you know, where I'm present as well. Now, of course, you know, you're going to hear these stories that they stumbled upon this place out in the middle of a field with an Art Deco building and came inside walking very carefully on a floor that had grass growing through it, and found a couple of turntables and a microphone, and my goodness, they opened a closet and all these records fell out. So I, you know, this is what you and Jeff are reporting, and I really didn't want that to get out. I mean, I kind of thought we could keep that under, you know, under wraps, but now it's become like general public knowledge now. So
right.
we've got. You know, Grant Hudson. Grant Hudson is on Friday nights, and why don't you give a little background on Grant? Because you know him very well, and you worked with this man, and what an incredible talent. But share with the folks who Grant Hudson is.
Well, remember by Federal Communications Commission law, radio stations used to have to carry a certain percentage of news, and of course they don't have to do that anymore. That was one of those things that went bye-bye in the car with deregulation. Certain radio stations, every radio station had to have the news, And so stations tried to bury the news. They'd put it on, you know, an hour long in the middle of the night, and they'd claim that they met their news commitment when in reality they hadn't. But the station that I worked at, CKLW, I say those call letters proudly, CKLW. And we, if I had to view the success of those stations and tell you why they were so successful, it was two things. The engineers, many of whom were ham radio operators, those guys had the beat. They understood the Motown beat. Yeah, and the fact that this radio station was a crossover radio station. It played music to the African-American community. It played music to the white community. It played music to people up and down the Eastern Seaboard, to Southerners and Northerners and Canadians. And so in many respects, this radio station was, again, touching so many lives. But the news, my goodness, the news was just exceptional. There was a fellow by the name of Dick Smythe. He worked at the radio station for 18 years, and he was the guy that taught all of these newscasters how to do this. I don't want to call it sensationalistic. I don't want to call it yellow journalism, but I would call it exciting news. You know, he just had a slant on it to have this fast-paced, hard-driving, you know, the Model 19 teletype was banging away in the back of these newscasts, that chunk, 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 you know, that sound of the teletypes that gave essence to the newscast. And anyway, Dick hired a young fellow by the name of Gary Mack, who changed his name, became Byron McGregor. He became the news director of the radio station around 1969, and he trained a number of really, really swell newscasters. That's a good word, isn't it? Swell. I like that. That's swell.
You can anyway, tell it's Mattel.
One of the folks that he hired was Grant Hudson. And at one point, that was a huge news department. The news department had 23 people in it. Can you imagine today, you know, an AM radio station in most of our markets has one or two or three. If they're lucky, maybe they have five newscasters in New York or Chicago or L.A., but this radio station in Detroit at that point in time had 23 employees. It was just and what a great news team. They had seven mobile cruisers. They had recorders out in the field. They were constantly updating the news. And if you wanted to know what was going on in Detroit, you had to listen to CKLW. A lot of what they hired people for was their writing skills. What do I mean by that? It was the ability to paint pictures with words. You know, when you're on the radio, it's kind of like teaching a blind man about the sun. You have to use descriptive words, adjectives, vibrant adverbs. You have to write copy so that it titillates. Yeah, it's using things like alliteration. I remember one of our liners that said, "We're bathing your body in Boss vibrations, baby." You know, now there's an example of alliteration. Yeah, but the newscasters had that too. Yeah, they really sometimes I think they went over the edge with it. You know, Buffalo Boy bashed and bruised, then strained through the grill of a Buick. Yeah, what can I say? There was sometimes when it was definitely over the top, but they really, really attracted the listener's ear. You could not. The thing about that radio station, I think any good radio station, you have to ask yourself, when the music ends, do you turn the volume up or do you turn the volume down? You know, if you turn it up, then what you put on the air is entertaining and you have earned their ears.
Well, I know with the news, the 2020 news, When the sounder came on, you did not change stations or else you don't know what you might miss, okay?
Right.
And that was the way it was portrayed. But Grant Hudson is on Friday nights, and he starts at 8 p.m. Central and goes till midnight. And then Saturday, of course, we're juggling some things around here. Jeff Lawrence will be on from 8 until midnight, and then, of course, Big Jim Edwards, Sunday nights.
Grant, I guess I didn't say that Grant was one of those people who was hired because he had this incredible ability to write. And I have to say, listening to Grant last Friday night on this radio station, 5.085, was you know, it's nighttime. And what I think about nighttime is that our senses are more intense. You know, when you take away the visual sense of daylight, all of a sudden at nighttime, our minds drift. We get to paint pictures with words. And here's this great Grant Hudson, who's on the air on Friday nights on this radio station, and he's telling stories. And he's a yarn spinner. He's a guy who can, you know, just off the top of his head, put these beautiful words together that paint these pictures. You're right in there with him. And I can just say, if you don't hear Grant on Friday night, you're missing something. Now, let's move to Saturday night. Jeff Lawrence is on the air. I mean, you want to talk about smooth? This guy wrote the word smooth. He is about as good as it gets in the radio business as a professional. You know, what he does for a living, he has a beautiful place. He and his wife, Carol, have a gorgeous place. They have 14 horses. They are in a situation where he has built a business of doing what we call voiceover work. He is a voice actor. And people hire him to be the representative for their radio stations, their TV stations, their social media, their websites, national voice of many, many big commercials. I guarantee you have heard his voice. If you've ever listened to Fox Sports, that's Jeff Lawrence. If you've ever listened to The Sweepers on this radio station, that's Jeff Lawrence.
I've got to tell you this story, you know, because we were doing music here, and I was doing the top of the hour IDs. I was doing the commercials. I was doing Sweepers. I was the one announcing the records, you know, and I began to think to myself, boy, am I sick of myself, man, if I could just, you know. And so anyway, I get this email from a listener. This is no joke. He writes, and this guy says, would you like some help? And I'm thinking, well, would I like some help? My goodness, would I love some help, you know? So anyways, you're always expecting the worst because there's a lot of folks think they can do voiceover work, you know. Anyways, here comes this sounder, if you want to call it that. That he sent, and it was a file, you know. He sent me, and I thought, well, I'm curious as to what this is, and I was not expecting what I was about to hear. And just as soon as I put it on and I hit the button, here this voice comes on and says, you know, broadcasting from a field just outside of Music City, USA, and then with miles and miles of wires and thousands of volts, you know, it was like, you know, he's saying we're broadcasting to planet Earth, you know, in this voice that I think, you know, and I don't know if he's listening. But to me, you know, he made Lyle Dean from WLS sound like a dwarf. Okay.
Oh, big voice. You know, and it's smooth. Such a treat to hear him. I mean, I think people have to understand, you do not hear Jeff Lawrence on any other radio station in America doing a disc jockey show. You can hear him here at 5085 every Saturday night. And trust me, it's a treat.
Oh, yeah. And he's very, very, I'll borrow a word from you, you know, he's very, very adept at painting pictures with words. Mm-hmm. And and that's everything, because that's all radio is word pictures and music and all that kind of stuff. But gosh, I mean, that blew me away. I could not believe somebody with that much talent wanted to get involved with this, you know.
Well, now, can we let a little cat out of the bag? I'm just going to drop a teaser here. You know, we do that in radio. We never really tell you the whole story until, it's out there on the radio. But it ain't over yet. We're building something that I can say Ted has allowed us to build that is going to be revolutionary, I believe. Let me just plant this little seed. We have one person who's going to join our team who has an acclaimed background in major markets all over the United States. You will know the name when you hear him. We have another person who's going to join us who was the number one nighttime jock at Z93 in Atlanta, Georgia. Big, big name, big voice. In fact, he was the national representative for Mellow Yellow. And he's going to be on our airwaves coming up real soon. So as they simply say, stay tuned.
Yeah, I guess, you know, it goes back to There was the movie Field of Dreams, and the whole thing was, if you build it, they will come. Sometimes I feel like that's what's happening here. We're gathering, and I'm amazed. I am absolutely, totally amazed by this whole thing, because it's everybody is so excited about it. Everybody wants to be right in the middle of it, and I'm loving it, because I believe this is what international shortwave radio deserves and what it should be.
As you pointed out, Ted, there are no accidents. There's a reason this all came together.
Oh, that's absolutely correct. Well, you know what? We're about out of time. We really are. Actually, we've gone over, but I don't care. You know, why would we care? You know, we don't have a consultant sitting here with a shotgun pointed at us. You know, saying, you know. Anyhow,
don't talk more than 20 seconds. If you talk more than 20 seconds, the listeners will tune away.
So why don't you kind of wind this up a little bit, Jim? If there's anything that you've wanted to express that I didn't let you do, or something you want to say, or David, if there's any questions that he's shaking his head no, but you should say it. People can't hear a head shake.
Absolutely.
Hot news.
Right, David. And thank you, David. I know the important part that you play with this station. I know the important part that Matt plays with this station. I know how important Holly is to this station. So these are behind the scenes people. I guess the audience should know that, you guys are not you're not out there in front of the microphone, but boy, it would not be possible without guys like yourself, David. So thank you very much. And in conclusion, Ted, I want to thank you for everything that you've done for me. It's wonderful to talk about ham radio. I hope that we do this many times again. I'm just going to close with, a saying, and then I'm going to end. And I will just say a saying that I've quoted for years, and I think that it's appropriate for tonight's broadcast. And that's that God gives us memory so that we can still smell the roses in December.
There you
go.
And
that's what we've done tonight. That's what we've done tonight.
Well, I appreciate you coming on. I appreciate for everything you're doing, especially with this project. You and Jeff and Grant have been fantastic, and all the new guys, I want to say new guys that are coming on board. And you know, it's all about it's all about memories, but it's also excuse me, it's also about fun. Having fun on radio. having fun on radio, which is something that's been a lost thing.
You're absolutely right, buddy. It's an honor to be a part of that fun.
I needed a gulp of my coffee here, but it's all gone. Anyhow, I thank all of you folks for tuning in, and I want to say 73s, and until next QSL Live, we bid you good evening, and thank you all for joining us, and thank you, Jim.
Broadcasting from an expansive field just outside of Music City, Nashville, Tennessee, USA, with miles of wires and thousands of volts. We transmit worldwide. WTWW, Lebanon, Tennessee, United States of America.
Folks, I want to talk to you for just a minute about the main trading company. The proprietor, Richard Lenore, KI5DX. It's interesting. I got a chance to sit next to him at Martin Jew's 45-year celebration in Starkville, Mississippi. And I learned quite a little bit about Richard sitting next to him. The first thing I learned is he is a ham radio guy through and through. His whole life is ham radio. He's the guy that started the Ham Fest in Paris, Texas. And now, of course, he's the proprietor of the main trading company. So I thought, well, you know, I'll go up on the website and take a peek and see what they got. But you know what? This is hard, and I'll tell you why. If you go up to the website, you're going to see amateur radio. You're going to see new open box demos. You're going to see connectors and adapters. And you're going to see educational toys. And FRS, GMRS, you're going to see radio accessories, you're going to see package deals. I mean, it's all up here. It's too numerous to mention. He's got radios. Of course, he carries Elenco, Kenwood, ICOM, Yaesu, MFJ. He's got all of Martin Jew's products over there at the MFJ. You can order anything you want to from Main Trading Company, and you get the best prices. There is just no way you can beat them. the main trading company, especially if you're west of the Mississippi near Paris, Texas, you need to buy from Richard Lenore, KA5DX, the main trading company. And it says here, free U.S. shipping on most orders over $100. You know, go up to their website, the main trading company, go up there and just Google them. If you can't find the website, Google them. Once again, they're in Paris, Texas. But they've got everything you could possibly want. And just to name a few things, they've got wires and cables and antennas and amplifiers and antenna tuners and radios and handhelds and VHF, UHF, the whole deal. And if you're confused and you've got questions, pick up the phone and call and talk to Richard Lenore. You can't go wrong. These are people that you'll love to deal with. You'll make friends for life. The main trading company in Paris, Texas. That's where you need to go.
Well, that's all the time we've got for QSO this week. We want to thank you for listening and ask you to join us again next week. Same time, same station, right here on WTWW.